Ekhatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekhatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we are strapping in to explore a really fascinating book. It tackles one of those big paradoxes of our time, right?
Which one's that?
Why do we feel so forgetful when, I mean, we literally have all the information in the world in our pockets?
Yeah. The constant brain fog despite the smartphone? I know it well.
Exactly. So we're diving into Joshua Foer's incredible journey, Moonwalking with Einstein, the art and science of remembering everything.
It really is the perfect deep dive for right now. We all carry like the sum of human knowledge around, mm-hmm. but we still forget why we walked into the kitchen. Foer's book basically argues this isn't, you know, some new flaw in our brains. Mm-hmm. It's more like cultural amnesia.
Yeah.
But his core idea is actually really optimistic. He says, exceptional memory isn't some genetic lottery win.
Right. Not just for savants.
No. He argues it's an ancient skill, something you can learn, but we've just sort of forgotten how to use it. It's been neglected.
And our mission today, really, is to give you the shortcut to understanding that skill. We want to pull out the specific techniques.
Yeah, the how-to.
The surprising science behind it, and maybe some of the bigger ideas about what it means to remember things in the first place.
So if you've ever wanted to get better at learning stuff or remembering names.
Oh, definitely names.
Or even just feeling a bit more present in your own life, this is definitely for you.
We probably won't turn you into a, you know, memory champion overnight.
Probably not.
But you'll definitely leave knowing how those folks actually do it.
Okay, so where should we start? The author.
Yeah, let's unpack Joshua Foer first.
Yeah.
Because he's kind of the perfect guide for this whole thing, mainly because he wasn't a memory expert to begin with, right?
Absolutely. That's key. Foer, he's an American freelance journalist, a science writer, you know, wrote for places like National Geographic.
Okay.
What makes him the ideal guide, like you said, is his starting point. He was a total outsider.
Just a regular guy.
Yeah, pretty much. Had an average memory, maybe even a bit forgetful, like most of us. He stumbled into this whole world purely as a skeptical reporter.
Right. Wasn't he assigned to cover the U.S. Memory Championship back in, like, 2005?
Exactly. This pretty obscure, kind of eccentric world of mental athletes.
I love that image. He's just watching these people memorize hundreds of random digits in minutes.
Yeah, decks of cards, long poems.
And he's probably thinking, okay, these people must have different brains. They must be wired differently, savants or something.
Totally bewildered. But then one of the competitors, a grandmaster of memory, basically challenged him, said something like, look, your brain's fine. You just don't have the right software. Yeah.
The right user manual.
Pretty much. And that comment flipped everything. His journalism assignment turned into this year-long personal quest. He got memory coaches, started training.
And the craziest part, he actually came back the next year, 2006, and won the whole thing, the USA Memory Championship.
Which makes the book, I mean, it's the ultimate proof of concept for its own argument, right? He didn't just report on it. He lived it. He became the guinea pig.
And his science writing background is crucial too, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. It meant he could look at these ancient techniques, these things that maybe sound a bit mystical.
Like the memory palace.
Yeah, exactly. And he could approach them with like journalistic rigor. He demystifies the neuroscience behind it all for, you know, a general reader. No jargon, no preaching.
He really bridges that gap between like ancient wisdom and modern brain science. It's impressive.
So, okay, the central idea of the book, it's not just a how to memorize grocery lists, is it?
Not at all. It's really a deep dive into how extraordinary memory actually gets made. Not inherited, but built, manufactured.
And it's got so many layers. The book kind of weaves together, what, like four different strands?
Yeah, something like that. You've got the personal story, Foer's own training diary, basically. Lots of frustration in there, too.
Oh, yeah. Wasn't easy for him. Then there's the investigative part. Diving into this weird, wonderful subculture of competitive memorizers.
The mental athletes.
Right. And then the history tracing these memory techniques back like to 2,500 years.
To Simonides and the Greeks.
Uh-huh. And finally, it ties it all together with the cognitive science, explaining why these techniques actually work with our brains.
And the really empowering part, the core claim, is that these amazing feats of memory, they don't depend on having some kind of super brain.
Nope. Standard hardware.
It's all about consistently using these ancient mnemonic tricks, techniques that turn boring abstract stuff into, well, unforgettable pictures in your head.
But there's also that philosophical layer you mentioned. Four uses memory to ask some pretty big questions about, you know, what we're losing now in the digital age.
Right, when we just Google everything.
Exactly. He argues that training your memory isn't just about remembering more facts. It's about living a richer life, a more attentive life, a life that's actually, you know, memorable.
It's kind of a wake-up call against this cultural amnesia we seem to be drifting into,
yeah,
where knowledge feels shallow because we don't internalize it anymore.
Yeah. The goal isn't the medal he won. It's about gaining control over your own mind, your own experiences.
Okay, so let's get into the nuts and bolts. The cornerstone technique, the first big one he learned, the memory palace.
Ah, yes. The memory palace. Or the method of loci, technically. This is ancient stuff. Goes back to a Greek poet, Simonides of Ceos, around the 5th century BC.
And the story behind it is amazing, right? The collapsing building.
Totally unforgettable. Simonides is at this big banquet, steps outside for a minute, and boom, the roof collapses, kills everyone inside, horribly mangled.
Oh, wow.
And nobody can identify the bodies. But Simonides realizes he can. He closes his eyes and just pictures where everyone was sitting around the table. He uses the locations to remember the people.
So that's the core idea, right? Using space.
Exactly. The technique totally hijacks our brain's natural evolved talent for remembering places, spatial memory. You pick a physical space you know incredibly well.
Like your childhood home or your walk to work.
Perfect examples. Your apartment, a museum you love, whatever. And you visualize walking along a specific route within that space, noticing specific spots or loci along the way. Your front door, the coat rack, the kitchen table.
Okay, got the space. Then what?
Then you take the abstract stuff you want to remember, playing cards, numbers, names, shopping list items.
Boring stuff.
Right, usually boring stuff. And you translate each item into a really bizarre, vivid, maybe funny, maybe shocking, multisensory image.
You stick those images onto the spots in your palace.
You place them there, yeah.
Yeah.
At each locus along your route. So the first item goes on the front door. The second hangs from the coat rack. The third is doing something crazy on the kitchen table.
And four emphasizes that the images have to be weird, right? Not just like a picture of the number seven.
Oh, absolutely critical. Boring doesn't stick. Our brains evolve to flag the unusual, the startling, the novel, even the rude or disgusting.
Because that stuff might signal danger. Or food, or mating opportunities, survival stuff.
Exactly. So you don't remember the abstract number 34. You remember, I don't know, Shaquille O'Neal dunking a flaming basketball through your living room window. That's memorable. That image gets mentally placed at a specific spot, say, your armchair.
So it's like you're taking the brain's built-in GPS system.
Yeah.
And tricking it into storing lists and data.
That's a great way to put it. Cognitive judo. Using the brain's strengths against its weaknesses for abstract info.
But just having a memory palace isn't enough to win championships.
Yeah.
There's more to it. Ford digs into the science of how people get really good really fast.
Right. This is where he brings in the research of Kay Unders Erickson, the expert on, well, expertise in peak performance.
Erickson's work. That's where the OK Plateau comes from.
Exactly. The OK Plateau. Think about learning to type or drive or maybe play a musical instrument. You practice, you get better. Up to a point.
Yeah, the point where it's good enough.
Right. You become proficient, it becomes automatic, muscle memory takes over, and you just stop improving. You plateau, maybe for years.
Ugh, I know that feeling. So how do these mental athletes, or any elite performer, keep getting better? How do they smash through that plateau?
The secret sauce, according to Erickson and Four, is deliberate practice.
Okay, what makes practice deliberate?
It's not just mindless repetition. It's highly structured. It's specifically designed to target your weaknesses. It constantly pushes you just outside your comfort zone. And crucially, it involves feedback.
So for memory training, that means what? Just building bigger palaces?
Partly, but it also means developing much more complex encoding systems. Ways to translate data into images much faster and more efficiently, often using a concept called chunking.
Chunking? Like remembering phone numbers in groups of digits?
Sort of, but on steroids. This leads to the really advanced technique Four had to master, the person-action-object system, PAO.
Okay, PAO.
Yeah.
Break that down for us. How is that more powerful than just single images?
Right, so PAO is like ultimate chunking. Instead of turning, say, one digit or one card into one image, you pre-memorize a unique person, a unique action, and a unique object for every single two-digit number from 00 to 99.
Whoa. That's a lot of prep work.
Oh, huge amount of upfront work. So, for example, maybe the number 23 is Michael Jordan, person, 45 is juggling, action, and 88 is chainsaws, object. You have a list of 100 of these triplets.
Okay, so then what?
So then when a mental athlete sees a sequence of 6 digits, like 23, 45, 88.
They don't see 6 separate things to remember.
Exactly. They see one image. They take the person from the first pair, 23 Jordan, the action from the second pair, 45 juggling, and the object from the third pair, 88 chainsaws. They instantly combine it into a single crazy image, Michael Jordan juggling chainsaws.
Wow, that's vivid.
And that single dynamic image represents 6 digits. They only need to place that one image at one spot in their memory palace. It massively increases their speed and how much they can pack in.
So the palace is the storage structure. But PAO is the super-fast encoding and compression tool.
You got it. That's how they handle hundreds of digits or multiple decks of cards so quickly.
That makes sense. It's a real system.
Yeah.
Now, to really appreciate what this kind of trained memory is, 4 also explores what happens when memory goes wrong, right? Either too much or too little.
Yeah, this part of the book gets really profound, I think. He contrasts the mental athletes with these 2 famous case studies. First, there was Solomon Shereshevsky, known as S., a Russian guy studied for decades.
He had the supposedly perfect memory.
Limitless, yeah. And synesthetic sounds had colors, words had tastes. But it wasn't a blessing, it was chaotic, a burden. He remembered everything, every tiny detail, every sensation.
Which sounds amazing, but...
But he couldn't filter. He couldn't forget the trivial stuff. And because of that, he really struggled with abstract thinking. You know, understanding concepts requires you to let go of specific examples and grasp the general idea. He couldn't do that easily.
So too much memory can be disabling in its own way.
In his case, yes. And then 4 looks at the opposite extreme, the tragic case of patient EP.
The man with severe amnesia.
Profound amnesia. Caused by a virus that damaged his brain. He basically lost the ability to form any new long-term memories. His memory reset every, like, 30 seconds to a minute.
God, that's hard to even imagine.
4's description of his life is just heartbreaking. It hammers home that memory isn't just like a filing cabinet for facts. It's the absolute bedrock of who we are, our identity, our story, our consciousness.
Without new memories, you're just trapped. Always in the present moment, unable to learn from experience, unable to even know who you are now.
Exactly. EP's story is this powerful, almost terrifying reminder that memory makes us human. It connects our past, present, and future.
And it makes what the mental athletes are doing seem even more remarkable, taking control of this fundamental human capacity.
Yeah, and the science actually backs up how they're doing it. When researchers finally scan the brains of these memory champs.
If they find bigger hippocampi. Some special memory bump.
Nope. Nothing structurally different. Their brains looked totally unremarkable, anatomically speaking. Standard issue hardware.
But functionally different when they were memorizing.
Ah, that's the key. When they were actively using their memory palaces, the scans lit up, specifically areas involved in spatial navigation and visual memory. The medial parietal cortex. The hippocampus.
The same parts of the brain we use to, like, find our way home.
Exactly. That's the little Rain Man and All of Us idea 4 talks about. They weren't accessing some secret memory module. They were cleverly repurposing the brain's existing navigation system.
So it really confirms the whole premise. The ability is learned software, not innate hardware.
Precisely. They just learned how to run this incredibly powerful ancient program on their perfectly normal brains.
Okay, so let's boil this down. What are the main takeaways for us? You know, people who just want to remember where we parked the car or someone's name.
Huh. Yeah. I think there are 3 really big themes that resonate. First, and maybe most important, memory is a skill, not a lottery win.
The empowering message.
Totally. It means your brain's limits aren't fixed. The secret isn't genetics, it's technique and practice, which is incredibly hopeful, right? If you're struggling to learn something new, maybe it's not you, maybe it's your method.
I like that. Okay. Second theme.
The second one, which I think is huge, is that the prerequisite for memory is attention.
Ah, you can't remember what you don't notice in the first place.
Exactly. To turn something into one of those sticky, bizarre images for your memory palace, you first have to consciously pay attention to it. You have to observe it, engage with it.
So training your memory is actually training your ability to be present.
That's a huge part of it. In our crazy distracted world, maybe the ultimate skill isn't recall, but focus. Actually noticing the details of your life so they can become memories.
Okay, good one. And the third.
The third is more of a critique, a warning maybe. The danger of cognitive outsourcing.
Meaning letting our devices do all the remembering for us.
Pretty much. 4 traces how memory training has declined over centuries, first with writing, then the printing press, now the internet and smartphones, we keep offloading our memory to external tools.
Which is convenient, obviously.
Super convenient. But Four asks, what are we losing? As individuals, as a culture, what's the cost of trading deep internalized knowledge for easily searchable surface-level facts?
It's that question again. Are our phones making us smarter in one way, but maybe shallower in another?
It's definitely something to chew on. Makes you think about your own relationship with information.
The book also has some lines that just stick with you. Real memorable quotes.
Oh, yeah, definitely. One of my favorites is, monotony collapses time, novelty unfolds it.
Ooh, I like that. Explain that one.
Well, Four connects memory to how we actually perceive the passage of time. If your days are all the same, routine, monotonous.
They just blur together.
Exactly. They collapse. And life feels like it's flying by, maybe even feels shorter. But novelty, new experiences, things that force you to pay attention, those create strong, distinct memories.
And those memories unfold time, making life feel richer, longer, more meaningful.
Right. So the quest to remember more is kind of linked to the quest to live more deliberately, more interestingly.
Okay. What's another good one?
This one speaks to how learning builds on itself. Memory is like a spider web that catches new information. The more it catches, the bigger it gets. And the bigger it gets, the more it catches.
So it's not like a computer hard drive that just gets full.
Exactly. It counters that idea. Knowledge is synergistic. The more you know, the more connections you have, the more hooks you have in your mental spider web to catch new information. Learning makes learning easier.
That relates back to chunking and those complex systems like PAO. They build a bigger web.
Perfectly put. And maybe the most powerful one, the real philosophical punch. Our lives are the sum of our memories. How much are we willing to lose from our already short lives by losing ourselves and our Blackberries or our phones by not paying attention?
Wow, that hits hard. It frames the whole issue, not just as cognitive ability, but as like the essence of living.
Right. The real cost of constantly outsourcing our attention and memory isn't just forgetting facts. It's potentially losing chunks of our own lived experience, the very stuff that makes up our identity. If you weren't present enough to form the memory, did that moment really count towards your life story?
Deep stuff. Okay, so let's bring it back to the practical. How can people listening apply some of this right now, even without building elaborate PAO systems?
Well, the most common request is remembering names, right? Social situations, networking events.
Always awkward when you forget someone's name 5 seconds after they say it.
Totally. The book's tip is basically force yourself to use elaborative encoding immediately. When you meet someone, consciously look for a distinctive feature on their face.
Like big ears or unusual glasses.
Whatever stands out. Then instantly create a bizarre, vivid image that connects their name, or something that sounds like it, to that feature.
Give an example.
Okay, say you meet someone named Penny, and she has really bright red hair. You could instantly picture, like, shiny copper pennies raining down onto her fiery red hair. The sillier and more sensory, the better.
So you're forcing yourself to pay attention to both the name and the face, and then actively linking them with a weird image.
Exactly. It feels a bit weird at first, but it works because it demands that initial moment of focused attention. And it definitely beats just repeating the name silently in your head.
Okay, what about for learning, like studying or work?
The memory palace, even a simple one, is way more effective than rote repetition for things like lists, key points for presentation, historical dates, even complex procedures or formulas.
So instead of flashcards, you could build a small palace for, say, the key arguments in a report you need to present.
Absolutely. Walk through your house mentally and place an image representing each key point in different rooms. Then during the presentation, you just mentally walk the route. No notes needed.
And there's a cognitive health benefit too, right? This isn't just about party tricks.
Definitely. Actively engaging in this kind of memory training, especially creating and navigating these visual spatial structures, it's like a workout for your brain.
Strengthens neural pathways.
Seems like it. Particularly those involved in visualization and spatial awareness. It's a way to keep your mind sharp and agile, exercising those cognitive muscles. Think of it as mental fitness.
So wrapping up, what was the most surprising thing or the biggest takeaway for you from this deep dive?
For me, I think it was really that democratization idea we talked about. The realization that this incredible ability isn't locked away for geniuses. It's fundamentally about technique, focus, and frankly, the belief that you can improve. Four proved it himself.
Yeah, that anyone can start small. You don't have to aim for the championship. Just memorizing your grocery list without a phone could be a start.
Exactly. And maybe realizing that training your memory is really just a side effect of training your attention, which feels like the more valuable skill today.
For me, it was that final philosophical point that Forrest's real prize wasn't the trophy. It was the internal shift, realizing his mind was way more powerful than he thought. And the ultimate goal isn't just remembering stuff, but consciously crafting a life that's actually worth remembering. A life filled with attention, with novelty, with experiences that stick because you were truly there for them.
The journey to remembering everything is really a journey to noticing everything.
Couldn't have said it better myself. A really profound thought to end on.
Indeed.
We hope this deep dive into moonwalking with Einstein has maybe sparked something for you, maybe inspired you to pay just a little bit more attention to the amazing world around you and inside your own head. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.